listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show, Outsmart Emotional Eating. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland. I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in eating disorders, and I know firsthand what it's like to struggle. I found the cure for binge eating. Yes, I did. There is a cure. And now I help people all over the world create binge-free, happy lives. And on this show, I am here for you too. Imagine waking up and thinking about your day, not your diet. How awesome would that be? That's what this is all about. Okay, so today we're going to talk about how understanding your attachment style, your relationship style, can help you overcome binge eating. And let me start with an example of Raquel. She was determined to win over her new boss. He was an older man known for favoring some employees over others. He was dismissive and even contemptuous towards her. He was horrible, but she was determined to win him over. And most nights she would come home from work, she would order pizza, and she would usually eat the whole pizza throughout the evening. And as she ate, her mind would be thinking about her boss, and she would be strategizing different ways to win him over. And she said, "Hey, I just feel like there's something I can get from my boss. Just feel like there's something there. If I can just stick with it, I know I'll get him to recognize me." This was her mantra. Now, to understand Raquel's determination to win over her boss, we have to go back to her childhood. When she was growing up, her father openly favored, you guessed it, her older brother. She could never win over her father. So in her job situation, she was experiencing, unbeknownst to her, totally unconsciously, she was experiencing her boss as almost like a do-over of her childhood. And she was hoping to win her father's approval through her interaction with her boss, who's essentially a stand-in for her father. And all that pizza? Well, that's a way of filling the void inside. Since she never felt like she had her father's approval, there was an emptiness, a void that she symbolically filled with food. A question on Instagram, are there any recordings of the past shows? There are indeed. You can go to the LA Talk Radio archives. You can also go to, it's available wherever there are podcasts. If you look for the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts, you can see almost 7 years of these shows. I just started doing the live stream during the pandemic, and I kept at it. So it's actually a live radio show, and then it's made into a podcast. So yes, absolutely. You're welcome. And if we have time, I will open up the phone lines. But if you are on Instagram, feel free to drop a comment anytime. Happy to hear from you. All right. So in our unconscious, authority figures often represent parents. That's why we sometimes react to our bosses the same way we did to our parents. And if you had to compete for attention in the past, if you had to vie for attention with other siblings, if you had sibling rivalry, if you felt like you were not the favored one, vying for attention from a boss or not letting a coworker get the better of you can be understood as like a repetition of your childhood. So rivalries at work are often rooted in tensions from the past. Coworkers can sometimes be experienced as siblings. Now, when I say that, I don't mean we're conscious of that. The whole point of this is to make the unconscious, what's hidden from us, what's in the dark, conscious. When we bring things into the light, we can see them. And when we see what we're fighting, then we can fight back. We can do battle. When we don't know what we're fighting, we just get beaten up. So that's why it's really important to look at, well, what is unconsciously affecting us? It may be out of our awareness, but it is not out of operation. We are not consciously aware, but oh my goodness, it is affecting us. And that goes for all the relationships that we have, including our relationship with food. So we often try to heal our original relationships, because when painful or unhealed, upsetting relationships from the past are not healed, the time does not heal all. P.S. It doesn't just magically go away. We don't heal. We just kind of recover from it. It doesn't hurt as much, but it's still an open wound. And when it's not healed, those relationships get played out over and over and over again in the present. And so the first step is to really acknowledge that those harmful and destructive patterns from the past and how they affect us. And I think it's really important here to recognize that what we're doing is we're explaining, we're not blaming. Two things that I hear a lot as a psychoanalyst is, oh, is it always about the past? The past is in the past. No, the past is not in the past. The past is haunting our present. So much of our choices in the present have to do with unhealed trauma or unhealed pain from the past. So we want to understand what happened in the past to heal it and better understand our present. And the other thing I hear is, I don't want to blame my parents. They did the best they could, or, you know, people did the best they could. I feel bad blaming them. Well, we're not blaming them. Blaming them is taking a victim stance. Although some actions, you know, we do want to blame. Child abuse, things like that. Yes, you blame people. Yes, absolutely. Some things are not forgivable. It's a whole other story. But in terms of blame versus explain, blaming is a victim stance, and it goes, oh, it's all their fault. Poor me. Whine, whine, whine. We don't want to do that. That's not what we're doing. We're saying, let's explain. Explaining is saying, okay, I want to understand how something happened so that I can better understand what happened in the past. How did it affect me so I can better understand myself in the present? And just as an example, let me tell you about Stan. He resisted the idea that something that happened in the past could affect him now. And whenever we talked about his childhood in sessions, and by the way, I should say all the names totally changed. These are not the true names or situations of these people. So when we talked about his past, he would get very uncomfortable. He would squirm in his seat. He'd say, look, I don't want to talk about my parents, he would say. They were good people. I feel guilty. I feel guilty talking about them in this way. You know, but the truth was that something in Stan's past was affecting him. When he was a kid, he played kickball outside all the time, and he often got hurt. And whenever he showed his mom one of the nasty scrapes he got, she would say, oh, you're fine. Stop complaining. So as an adult, when Sam felt hurt or upset emotionally or in any way, he would tell himself to just suck it up and not complain. And instead, he turned to food for comfort. And by the time Stan came to see me, he weighed nearly 400 pounds. He was in constant pain. He had high blood pressure. His health was at risk. He had internalized his mother's attitude towards both physical and emotional pain. Suck it up. You're fine. Stop complaining. And I explained to him that recognizing this connection wasn't about blaming her. It was about understanding how his past had affected him. Again, blaming is a victim stance. It is not helpful. It is not helpful to point a finger and say, it's their fault. But it is helpful to have some understanding of how you developed certain ways of being in the world, certain ways of relating to yourself. And with time, Stan learned to express his feelings and stop using food as a way of avoiding them. And eventually he could heal from his past. He could improve his present. He could respond to himself differently. And again, most parents try their best, but sometimes they respond to their children problematically. They respond to their children the way they were responded to. But when we internalize those behaviors, you know, they become part of who we are. But healing from the past changes that. It changes how we respond to ourselves, and it changes who we are. And again, is it always about the past? Well, to understand the present, we really have to understand where our beliefs about ourselves come from. Now, when you think about psychoanalysts, where's my Freud? I have this Freud action figure. I don't know where it is. It's here somewhere. Oh, here it is. Here's my Sigmund Freud action figure. So when you think about psychoanalysis, you might picture Freud listening to a patient on the couch, silently rubbing his beard. But let me tell you, first of all, comparing Freud to modern analysis is like comparing a Model T Ford to a Tesla. Yes, they are both cars, but yes, they are worlds apart. And by the way, Freud wasn't even Freudian. He fed his patients. He gave them tea and even cookies and things. He was actually quite warm. So psychoanalysis isn't just one type of therapy, by the way. It is a bunch of different theories, philosophies, techniques. It is all aimed at helping people live more freely and authentically. And the idea is to help you understand why you act in self-destructive ways and create new ways of relating to yourself so you don't do that, as opposed to just focusing on the symptom or the behavior. And when it comes to binge eating, we don't want to just focus on the behavior. That won't change anything. That's willpower. That's control. Eventually, it will fail. And you don't want to spend the rest of your life going, I won't eat that. That's horrible. We don't want that. Because you can go on diet after diet after diet. You can vow to be good. Nothing is going to change in the long run. Focusing on the behavior of binging is like just yanking up a weed. If you just get the visible part of the weed, it won't solve the problem. You need to get rid of the root. And so the roots to binge eating are the ideas, the beliefs, the emotions, low self-esteem, negative body image, perfectionism, need for control, emotional distress, stress, anxiety, depression, loneliness, boredom, trauma, all the things. All these factors lead to an unhealthy relationship with food because you have an unhealthy relationship with you, and eating is a way of coping to numb the pain. And binge eating can be a really vicious cycle because painful emotions that you feel, you eat, you feel bad. You can't simultaneously feel bad and support yourself if you don't have a way of coping. If you don't have a way of supporting and encouraging yourself, food becomes the answer. And that's why people say, I don't understand it. I can't stop eating. I know it's not good for me. I know I shouldn't be doing it, but I keep doing it. And then I do it some more. And that's because it's not logical. It's psychological. We really have to understand the psychology behind binge eating in order to break the cycle. And one major factor is our relationship style, our attachment style. Keep in mind, people can be unpredictable, unreliable, unavailable. Food is always predictable, reliable, available. Let me give you some examples of different attachment styles and think about which of these can you relate to. Again, all the names are disguised. So the first one I call out of sight, out of mind. Deirdre had been in a relationship for 8 years. Her boyfriend loved her, was affectionate, was committed, was totally obviously in love with her. And yet, despite all of his reassurances, she always felt like she was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. She was afraid that sooner or later, he would leave her. She was convinced of it. Nothing could break her conviction that it was just a matter of time and it was going to end. And even though they talked about getting married, they talked about growing old together, they talked about having kids, all the things, she just couldn't shake this anxiety. And she told herself that marriage would be a setup, that it would only backfire. So to her, it felt like the higher she climbed in life, the farther she would fall. So how did Deirdre come to feel this way? fearing that any attachment was just a setup for loss and that the closer you get, the more you had to lose. Well, she grew up in Australia. She had a perfect, as she put it, perfect and very idyllic childhood. And she spent her days surfing. She hung out with friends. She played volleyball on the beach. She felt like she was living in paradise. It was fabulous. And then one day, she came home from surfing and her parents sat her down and they announced that they were getting a divorce. And Deirdre was blindsided. She felt like her world just fell apart all at once. Just, and as a result, she grew up expecting that every relationship would end suddenly and unpredictably. And so she couldn't allow herself to trust that her boyfriend was in it for the long haul, that he really would love her. Because in her mind, being in paradise, if you step into paradise, you're just going to get kicked out suddenly and unpredictably. The only thing that seemed to calm her down was eating fast food. So whenever she went through a drive-thru, she would find a few moments of peace without worrying about loss and worrying about all the things that she was constantly worried about. So Deirdre ended up with a stay close, because if I let you go, you'll leave me mentality about connections, but even closeness didn't reassure her. And this is an anxious, preoccupied relationship style. And people with this kind of relationship style, they struggle to trust the reliability of those that they care about. And they struggle to trust that other people truly do care about them. It feels to them like the bond is only one way. Like they care about the other person. It's hard for them to believe that the other person also cares about them and loves them. And they want, you know, if you've got this kind of relationship style, you crave constant contact. You worry that any time apart could end the relationship. And you still need constant reassurance that your partner is still there for you. If this sounds like you, then you might worry about losing love if you ever do find it. Even if you're not with someone special, it can feel like it's not enough. You could be in a constant state of fear that they'll leave you, that you're too needy, that it's all going to blow up in your face. And these anxieties can make your relationship feel really shaky. And again, you may turn to food to either calm down, reassure yourself, or fill the emptiness. We all carry baggage from the past. It can hurt us a lot in the present. But if you can face your fears and insecurities, if you can work on healing those old wounds, your life in the present can change drastically. So even your eating habits will change for the better once you find new ways of reassuring yourself, showing up for yourself, really an attachment for you. Once Deirdre faced her fears and she left her old habits behind because she could take in the relationship, she could take in that had happened to her parents, but it didn't mean that that was destined to happen for her. And she could process the pain and mourn what had happened and start to take in that people were attached to her and that the bonds of attachment could be reliable and strong. When she could reassure herself of that, she didn't need food for comfort or distraction or as a constant in a world of uncertainty. She felt comfort in her relationship instead of with food. Happy ending. All right. The other relationship style, I call it the I don't need anyone. I don't need anyone. Relationships, no thank you. All right. So even before the pandemic, Rita had an online business. She worked from home for years before the pandemic. Most of her business dealings where they were on the internet. So she hardly ever interacted with real people. And that did not bother her at all. She had no problem with that. She was a proud mama of three fur babies, cute little dogs. And she believed that her dogs were all that she needed for company. So her only human contact came from chatting with her fellow dog owners, or I don't feel right calling myself a dog owner. Kind of feel like, you know, he owns me, actually, my Great Dane. I'm just his slave, right? I don't own him. her fellow dog people at the local park. She would chat with them about dogs and things like that. And after work, she always ordered her favorite dinner from a local restaurant, and she would eat until she was too full to move. And then she would feel guilty and unhappy about her weight. So by eating so much, again, she was filling a void that she couldn't even consciously recognize she had. Fur baby parents. Yes, that's what we are. We are not owners. We are fur baby parents. Thank you, Randy. Yeah. So by eating so much, she was filling a void that she didn't even recognize that she had. And when we dug deeper, we discovered she was really scared of getting into a relationship because she was afraid of losing herself in that relationship. After all, her mom had given up everything to be with her dad. And so to her, that meant she would have to give up everything she loved to make the other person happy. She would say things like, well, what if I meet someone and they don't like dogs and then they want me to give up my dogs? I'm not doing that. So already she imagined that a relationship meant giving up of herself and being almost subsumed by the other person, and that the other person's needs and wants were everything. And that was her model. Her parents were her model for how she imagined relationships would be. So it was this fear of losing herself in a relationship that made her be afraid of any real, meaningful connections. So she had a dismissive, avoidant attachment style. And the thinking along that lines is, I don't need to be close. I don't want to be close. I'm just keeping my distance. I don't need anybody. I'm not needy. Oh, no. So people with a dismissive, avoidant relationship style often shy away from any kind of intimate relationships because they fear it will lead to some kind of rejection, some kind of pain, or loss of self. So if you avoid closeness like this, you might feel lonely. You might feel disconnected, which can make you more prone to using food to fill that void. So Rita had to challenge the belief that being close to others meant sacrificing her independence, her sense of self, her dogs, anything she cherished or cared about. And she began taking small little baby steps towards building connections. And by spending time with people in a way that felt comfortable with her, and by starting to experience that she could be close to people without them draining her, taking over, having expectations of her that were unreasonable, all of those things, she found herself eating a lot less than she used to, but enjoying it more because she was eating for dinner, not for distraction. Not to fill a void, not symbolically. So as you can see, our relationship style has a lot to do with how we experience our yearning for love, hunger for love, right? Hungry for love, starving for affection. Our culture uses so many words that reference that our need for relationship or our conflicts of relationship have also to do with food. We're starving for affection. We're hungry for love, right? We have fulfilling, satisfying relationships. These are all words we also use about food. So consider that. And let me know if any of this resonates with you. All right, the next one is called, I call it, He Went From Hot to Not. Shelby had a thing for bad boys. Oh, yeah. She fell hard for a married guy. She chased a man who only went for brunettes, and she was a blonde. She dated someone who lived in Dubai, even though she lived in Southern California. He only visited, you know, like, I don't know, once a month or something. So she was always after these bad boys who were completely unavailable. And whenever a boring guy, that's how she put it, boring, a boring guy showed interest, she ran in the opposite direction. And then she met a guy who was kind of lukewarm about her. He wasn't that interested. And that's when Shelby tried everything she could to make him like her. And it worked. She made him like her. They started dating. The guy fell for her. They started dating. And after a few months, he wanted to make things exclusive. Now, you would think Shelby would be elated, right? Oh, yes, I won him over. Now he wants me. Fabulous. Oh, no, that is not how it went. Because as soon as he wanted to make things exclusive, she ditched him. For her, he stopped being hot as soon as he wanted a genuine commitment. So like Shelby, many people with a fearful, avoidant attachment style fear getting close. They might fall for someone who's already taken. Now, they want to get close. They're fearful, avoidant, right? They want it, but they're scared of it. They might fall for someone who's already taken or who lives too far away to see all the time, like, oh, say, Dubai. Or they choose workaholics or people who are disinterested or unable to reciprocate. They want love, but they also fear it. And so they spend their time in an endless cycle of chasing, but never really catching someone. And if they do catch the person, they throw them back into the waters of love, the sea of love. So as soon as someone shows interest, that's when they change their mind. And that's when people go from hot to not. So there are different reasons for this kind of relationship style. Some people like the thrill of the chase, but they can't stand the idea of an actual relationship. Or as we discovered with Shelby, they don't feel worthy of love on some level. So they avoid closeness at all costs. Yet Shelby was sad because she really did want connection. And whenever she felt lonely, she binged to the point of feeling completely stuffed, actually in physically in pain, actually in physical pain. And instead of feeling fulfilled in relationships, Shelby filled up with food. Now, Shelby faced her fear of getting close to people, and she began to see that relationships could satisfy her instead of scare her. The more she allowed herself to connect with others, the less she needed to eat to symbolically fill the void. And may I say again, nobody that I'm talking about here was aware that they were eating to symbolically fill the void. For them, they felt like they were addicted to pizza or just, you know, had no willpower, had no control. I'm a food addict. I have no control about food. They did not recognize the relationship between their relationship style and the emptiness they felt, the loneliness, the conflict, and eating as a way of filling the void. And I should also say that food represents people on some level. So sometimes when people are, as I said before, when people are unpredictable, unavailable, unreliable, food, which represents people in our psyches, is available, is predictable, is reliable. So the more that Shelby allowed herself to connect with others, the less she needed to eat to fill the void. And now Shelby is seeing someone new. Oh, yes. And although it is sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes she just wants to crawl out of her skin, she is learning to also enjoy feeling close and realizing that that scary, I gotta get away, escape. That feeling is temporary and that she doesn't have to act on it. She can reassure herself and she can soothe herself with words. And she is learning to enjoy feeling close. So it is possible for all of us to face our fears and enjoy the richness of love. So those are three relationship styles that are problematic and that lead to problems with food. Now I'm going to tell you a fourth relationship style. I call it the, of course you love me. Of course you do. Have you ever wondered what it's like to feel truly loved and secure? Well, my friend Tommy, not his real name, He is one of the countless actors from all parts of the world who come to Hollywood to try to make it big in movies and TV. And auditioning can be really stressful since most of the time actors are rejected. In fact, it's typical for working actors, people who actually make a living acting, to go on 20 auditions for every one job that they book. So they have a 20-to-1 ratio. So how is it possible that some actors like Tommy manage to book nearly every role they audition for? Tommy is definitely one of those people. And he is honest enough to admit he is no more talented than anybody else. In fact, he'll say, like, there are a lot more talented people out there than he is. But he doesn't let that bother him. He doesn't let that stop him. Unlike many other actors, he approaches each and every audition, like, with total confidence. He walks in thinking, like, of course you're going to like me. Of course you're going to love me. And guess what? He's right. It's that mindset of self-assurance that makes him relaxed and comfortable, which in turn makes him, you know, do great at reading his lines and relating to the casting directors, and it's all good, and they love him, and he books these jobs. So you want to know the secret? You want to know Tommy's secret? How is he so confident? Because it's a real confidence. He's not like, yeah, you love me. No, it's like, of course you love me. So here's the thing. Tommy's family was always there to love and support him. And that sense of being, you know, cherished, being loved, being just irreplaceable, carried him throughout his life. So in both his personal relationships and work, he is lucky enough to have what's called a secure attachment style. When you feel truly lovable, it is natural to believe that other people are going to feel the same. So being comfortable with ourselves and with others allows us to have intimate, meaningful relationships that can enrich our lives. And when you have that, when you have inner peace and fulfillment, you don't use food as a substitute for love. So cultivating a fulfilling relationship with yourself and with the people around you can really bring more love, light, and joy into your life. When you have that, you don't need food to distract yourself, food for fun, food for comfort, food to soothe you. And by the way, I should say one thing about casting directors. Talk about the ultimate bosses. As I was talking earlier, that bosses can register in our psyches as parents. So if you go into a room with a casting director and there's someone who's observing you, who's scrutinizing you, and it could feel like they're judging you. And if you had parents who were judgmental, or, you know, or grandparents, or someone significant in your life who were judgmental, critical, nothing you did was ever good enough, then it could really feel as if, you know, you're going in to be judged by these people. And so you walk in and instead of feeling like yourself, confident, capable, able, it's like you go back into some regression in which you're just dodging these judgmental eyes, and then, you know, it's all over. You can't be yourself when you feel so scared and judged and, you know, under the spotlight of criticism. So consider which of these relationship styles resonates with you. And answering this question is a great place to start your journey to making peace with your fears about relationship and with food. Because when you identify which relationship style fits you and you dig deep and look at how did you develop it, you can work to create lasting change. So which relationship style do you relate to most? If you're on Instagram, let me know in the comments. If you would like to call in, you know, we have time, so I could take callers. The call-in number is 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is eating at you, weighing on you, because, you know, when it comes to binge eating, emotional eating, any kind of food issue, the real problem is not food. It's not what you're eating that is the problem. It is why. And when you get to that why, you can create lasting change. And that's why I believe in liberation instead of recovery. You know, recovery is, it's like I was saying before, it's about willpower, it's about control, it's about every day waking up and saying, I will not eat carbs, I will not eat sugar, I will be good. And then your sense of self and good enoughness is predicated on what you eat, which is a terrible way to go through life every day, as opposed to not dieting, showing up for yourself, being able to support, encourage, be nice to yourself, you know, comfort yourself, soothe yourself, engage yourself. You know, when you do that, you don't need food for all those things or to distract yourself. You know? So recovery is every day going, I'm in recovery. I'm in recovery. I'm in recovery. You're always in it. That doesn't sound fun. That's not good. Liberation is what I agree, what I'm all about. I agree with the idea of liberation. Liberation is you wake up and you think about your day, not your diet. Liberation is, hey, binge eating, emotional eating, all of that. That's something I used to do. That's in my rear view mirror. I don't do that anymore because I learned new ways of coping, and it was never about food. Food is the solution to the problem. It is not the problem. The problem is your relationship with yourself. If you're a perfectionist, if you don't know how to deal with anxiety or depression, if you don't know how to encourage yourself and if you speak unkindly to yourself or critically, or you think you're motivating yourself with vicious thoughts, you're not. You're just making you want to get away from yourself, which, by the way, eating does. When you're binging, you're taking yourself away from your own mean voice. So liberation is when you've learned new ways of being with yourself. When that happens, food is breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks. And by the way, it better be delicious. Not, I can't have that. I should have that. Oh, let me count my macros. Oh my God. You know, all of that. We have other things to think about, don't we? We have other things on our minds, right? You have other things to think about than numbers. And by the way, I say this as someone who spent every day for years and years and years and years only thinking about numbers. Every day I would wake up and plan out what I was and wasn't going to eat that day. Every day I would wake up and plan to be good. And you know, some days I'd meet my goal. But I was always thinking about it. I wasn't in my life. If I was hiking with friends, I wasn't thinking, oh my God, this is so beautiful. Oh, this mountain is so lovely. Or, oh, I'm enjoying my time with my friends. Oh no, I was busy calculating how much I'd eaten and how many calories I was burning in that hike. I was constantly thinking about food, weight, calories. It took up 90% of my mind. I'm surprised I ever got anything accomplished because all I did was think about numbers. And getting on the scale could make or break my day. If I gained a pound, it was disaster. And I felt terrible about myself. That's why I don't get on the scale anymore, by the way. I highly recommend you break up with the scale. A piece of metal and plastic cannot measure your self-worth. So don't worry. Don't think like, oh, if I get rid of my scale, I'm just going to blow up like a balloon and I'm going to, you know, gain 100 pounds. No, you're not. The scale is a dictator in your life. So I share this to say I have been there. I was a person who only counted numbers. I was a person whose self-worth was dictated by how much I weighed, what people thought about me. And I was really mean to myself, and I was perfectionist. Nothing I did was ever good enough. I was harsh on myself. I was the poster child for eating disorders. I would restrict. I would binge and purge, all of it. And you know, eventually I went to therapy, but I went for anxiety. my therapist had no idea I was, in fact, the poster child for eating disorders. And I talked about guys and goals and dreams and fears and all the things. I never once talked about food. But by the time I left therapy, all my eating disorder behaviors were gone for good. And not once, not a single time, never, ever, ever, ever had I talked about food. Never. And people say, how is that possible? How do you get over all eating disorders without ever talking about food? And the answer is simple. Food was never the problem. It was the solution to the problem. The problem was my self-criticism. The problem was my judgmental attitude towards myself. My problem was my inability to self-soothe, my inner taskmaster. These were the problems. Turning to food or restricting or all the things I did, those were the solutions to the problem. So if you are turning to food, there is always a reason. Maybe that reason is you're trying to escape your own mean voice. Maybe the problem is you've been dieting, and dieting sets you up because dieting is about deprivation on some level, always. And either the experience or the anticipation of deprivation always makes you want something more. If we tell ourselves we can't have something, we want it. We want it more. And then when we do have it, we have a whole bunch of it. And we tell ourselves, well, this is the last time I'm going to have it, because then I'm going to go on a diet. And I'm going to not have it anymore until I lose X amount of weight. And then I can have it again. So I might as well have a lot now, like you're banking that food. But all it does is turn into a binge, and then you feel terrible about yourself, and on and on and on and on and on. And I am here to tell you there is a new way, another way. Someone reviewed my book recently, my binge cure book, and said that they had a problem with the title, because they're just a reviewer. They're not a psychologist. They're not a psychoanalyst. They're not in the mental health field. Nothing. They said, there's no such thing as a binge cure. So this title is incorrect, essentially. Yes, there is such thing as the binge cure. And I have spent 20 years doing this work and helping a lot of people achieve the binge cure or the bulimia cure or the whatever it is. You can change your relationship with food by changing your relationship with yourself. And our relationship with yourself has a lot to do, as I talked about today, with your expectations of relationships with other people. When we have, when we are mean to ourselves and we're judgmental to ourselves, and someone comes along and they're mean and judgmental, it feels very familiar. We're going to say, oh, yes, you know me well. Let's be together. And then nothing changes. But when you're kind to yourself and supportive and generous, when you encourage instead of discourage yourself, and someone comes along and they're judgmental, you're going to say, next, pass, don't need you in my life. And when you are self-accepting and love yourself, and I like self-acceptance because it includes love, but it also includes the things you don't love about yourself, as opposed to I've got to be perfect to be lovable. And someone comes along and they love you, you can take it in. You can believe it because you feel lovable. You feel good enough. You don't have to change something about yourself in order to be lovable. You're not going to be more lovable when you lose weight. You're going to be less lovable if you gain weight. You know your value. You know your truth. So when I talk on this show, as I have talked for nearly 7 years, I've done the show on LA Talk Radio. When I talk about the binge cure, and when I talk about hope, and when I talk about liberation, it's not just something I'm talking about for you. It's something I've experienced. It's something I know what it's like to struggle. I know what it's like to just have those thoughts every day, wake up to swearing, I'm going to be good. And every day wake up, go to sleep thinking, am I going to wake up, in the morning, will I have lost weight or gained weight? Or every night go to sleep going, okay, how many calories did I have? What was I good? Was I good? and thinking that it is impossible to ever change the way you think or feel about food or yourself. It may seem impossible, but as the great Nelson Mandela said, it is always impossible until it is done. So I'm here to tell you from personal and professional experience, you can change your relationship with yourself. You can change your relationship with others. You can change your relationship with food for good. That's liberation. That's when you wake up and you think about your day and not your diet. You think about what makes you happy. What do you want to do? Not what should you eat or not eat. Okay. We have a few minutes. So if you have any questions on Instagram, drop them in the comments. About 5 more minutes of the show since I'm not getting calls. I will just look at some of the questions that people have sent in. This one person says, why do I feel like I'm the only one who struggles with emotional eating? Well, I don't know why you feel you're the only one, because a lot of people struggle with emotional eating. I will also share that binge eating disorder is the most prevalent eating disorder. More people struggle with binge eating disorder than anorexia and bulimia combined. And by the way, I believe the number is much higher. It's that a lot of people don't realize they have binge eating disorder. They think they're food addicts. They think they have no control. They think they have no willpower. They are wrong. This is not about control or willpower. It is a way of coping. It is a frenemy. It is a friend. It's doing something for you. It's helping you cope. It's distracting you. It's helping you display certain feelings. Sometimes if you're angry about a situation in your life, but it's kind of scary to be angry for whatever reason, or there's nothing you can do about it, sometimes that anger about certain situations gets displaced onto anger about food, or you can't control certain areas of your life. So that gets displaced into, oh, I have no control over food. When really it's, oh, I have no control about other things in life. And one of the tough parts of life is coming to terms with the fact that, you know, things happen. There's only so much that we can control, which is a huge bummer, but there it is. But you know, it's a way of displacing from one area of life onto food, whether it's anger or control or what have you. Sometimes it's easier to focus on what you're eating than to look at what's eating at you, to know what maybe you don't want to know. And often people will say, oh, you know, if I were not thinking about food, I might want to leave my partner. I might want to move to a different country, but I can't do that. That would disrupt my life. I can't think about that. If you are thinking about food all the time, if you are eating, if you are obsessed, if you feel just like a preoccupation about it, there is some reason for it. And being curious, not critical, being really curious about that why. What would I be thinking about if I were not thinking about food? What would be on my mind if I wasn't focused on this? Instead of calling myself, big, what are my big feelings? Instead of, feeling fat, because fat is not a feeling, what's too much for me? What are my big emotions? What's too much in life right now? Think about that. These are all important things to ask yourself. If you just focus on what you are eating and what you weigh, instead of what's eating at you and what's weighing on you, nothing will change. And you're going to be miserable. But when you really dig deep, which is hard, it's easier to focus on dieting and calories and all of that than it is to focus on what's upsetting, or what's making you feel anxious, or what's making you feel concerned or worried or upset. But when you look at that, you dig out the roots of this behavior and you deal with it, then you're done. That's liberation. When you avoid it, nothing goes away. And you cannot positive think it away, can't ignore certain thoughts and feelings, you can't drop them. You can't stuff them down. You can't gratitude them away. The only thing you can do is face them and feel them. And what you feel, you will heal. So there you have it. Okay. That is my show for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, psychoanalyst. I am here to help you create a binge-free, happy life. I'm here on LA Talk Radio every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, or you can listen later wherever you get podcasts. And if you would like a deeper dive into this topic and many, many more, check out my book, The Binge Cure, 7 Steps to Outsmart Emotional Eating. It is available on Amazon in every format, including audiobook, when I read it to you. How's that? I'll read you a story. All right, stay curious, not critical. I'll see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.